Welcome. Welcome to the 60th annual Michigan School Testing Conference. That's quite a noteworthy accomplishment. And no, the rumor's not true that I've been to every one of them, but many of them. And we welcome you because we, once again, have put together, a really nice program that combines sessions put on by the Michigan Department of Education and local educators and others. So on behalf of the Planning Committee, I'm glad that you chose to join us in Ann Arbor. We've arranged for just a little touch of weather tomorrow because that's the tradition of this conference as well. It shouldn't be too disruptive, but we'll work around that as we need to. And I really want to commend the Michigan Department of Education staff who are here because if they were back home, they would not be working. Apparently, there's a heating problem in the state government complex, and there are a lot of state employees, I think, that went to work and had the day off. But these intrepid individuals are here in the conference ready to present, even though they could be back home goofing off for the day. So I think we owe them appreciation. I'd also like to welcome a group of educators in the Upper Peninsula. Once again this year, we've managed to set up a virtual link. The camera back here in the corner will be beaming our plenary speakers, Tom Guskey this morning and Andy Middlestead at noon, and then three clinic sessions to them. And we appreciate that they can join us virtually. I thank Carla Strom from the Copper Country ISD for helping to make the arrangements for that this year. That will mean that the doors on this side of the room will be locked. We don't want people coming in and interrupting the video presentation. People can exit the doors, but they can't come back in. They'll have to use the one in back there. I particularly want to thank the NWEA. They're providing the financial support to the conference for the breakfast this morning and the AM and PM breaks. Companies and organizations like NWEA provide a goodly amount of support for the conference, and that helps to keep your registration fees down. And for that, we're very appreciative. I ask that each of you silence your cell phones. We'll have cell phone shaming for those phones that go off, not the people, but the phones that go off that you fail to silence. And if you're not using devices, one of the things that's challenging here, we've tried to work on it, making a little progress, but getting access to the conference network can be a challenge. So if you're not using a device, like a phone, and you're using your computer, would you please turn them off, not just silence them? The fewer users there are trying to access the network, that will be the better. So with that, I usually fail to introduce myself. I'm Ed Raber, the conference director. It was an old habit that I learned from my MEEP days that if I didn't introduce myself, the people didn't know who to complain about what I said. So anyway, Ed Raber, conference director, glad to be here. And on behalf of the conference committee, welcome. And at this point, I'm going to introduce Kathy Dewsbury-White, who's CEO and president of the Michigan Assessment Consortium. And she'll, I know, do a lovely introduction of our speaker, Tom Guskey. Thank you.
Well, good morning, MSTC 2020 participants. It's a pleasure to introduce Tom Guskey to you this morning. His work is dedicated to helping teachers and school leaders use quality educational research to help all students learn well and gain the many valuable benefits of that success. And I'd like to highlight that summary statement again because the focus is on equipping practitioners to use quality educational research to improve their own practice, with the understanding that our purpose is teaching and learning. And I think he is a perfect blend of expertise and background for this conference, where we have researchers, we have practitioners, and we make the bridge between the two. Now I'm going to share some of Tom's official bio with you. He is a senior research scholar in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Louisville and professor emeritus in the College of Education at the University of Kentucky. He's a graduate of the University of Chicago. He began his career in education as a middle school teacher, served as an administrator in Chicago Public Schools, and he was the first director of the Center for the Improvement of Teaching and Learning, a national research center. He's an author-editor of 25 award-winning books and more than 250 book chapters, articles, professional papers on topics ranging from educational measurement, evaluation, assessment, grading, and professional learning. His articles have appeared in prominent research journals, including the American Ed Research Journal, Educational Researcher, Review of Educational Research, as well as practitioner publications that we read, such as Ed Week, Educational Leadership by Delta Kappa, and The Learning Professional. He's received many awards and a variety of recognitions. He's been named fellow in the American Educational Research Association, which is the association's highest honor, and he's also received the association's prestigious Relating Research to Practice Award. So, you conduct research, but more importantly, you translate research for practitioners. And you work with practitioners to understand how what we know at a given time about learning can reasonably be incorporated into our current practice and inform our policies. I mentioned in email with you that we shared a common professional friend, Jane Bailey, who sadly died a few years ago. You co-authored a couple of books with Jane, and during the writing, later the publishing and the sharing of the work, Jane said to me, "You know, my part in this is to keep it real, so that we can share in a way that teachers and administrators can see themselves in the work." And I think this takes us back to your commitment to translating the research for the practitioner. Not in your bio, but in the acknowledgement sections of the book Evaluating Professional Development, which is really a classic, I learned that you were a student of Benjamin Bloom's while you were at the University of Chicago, and that that's where you were introduced to evaluation. One important area of interest for you throughout your career has been professional learning, and I want you to know that that publication, Evaluating Professional Development, was very formative in my early career. You gave me guidelines that helped push my efforts to design professional learning opportunities that reached for impact on students and minimized the collection of information about simple reactions to the professional learning opportunity. And I learned people are going to tell you about the temperature of the room, you know, and whether or not the brownie was dry during the PM snack, whether you ask them or not, and so you really do not need to ask them. So I appreciate your outlook, your attitude, your approach. You don't shy away from sharing and translating what we can glean from research that can affect our behavior and practice positively, but you remain clear that there is always more to learn. In a short piece published in EdWeek a year ago, you concluded that, and the title of it was "Let's Give Up the Search for Best Practices in Grading." And you concluded that piece by saying, "Our goal should be to use the knowledge base we have to do things better than we are doing now. We need to see grading and reporting more as a challenge in effective communication rather than simply one of quantifying student achievement. We need to stop using grades to sort and rank students and instead use them to guide students in making improvements in their learning." So would you help me in welcoming Tom Gusky?
Thank you. Wow, that was terrific. Thank you, Kathy. You need to come home and introduce me to my mom, right? Yes. And thanks to everybody for coming to be a part of the conference today. I know this is a busy part of the school year, and you will pay a price for having been here today. We hope to make that price worthwhile. But also to come to talk about the issue of grading is really, really challenging. I know this is sort of my standard introductory slide to presentation on the grading. If I was going to be honest with you, I'd use this instead. And if I was really going to be honest with you, I'd probably use this. I wanted to start by sharing with you some contact information for me, because I really hope that today isn't the last of our conversations. I hope that this will just prompt additional conversations, and not only with your school, but also between us. So if there are times when I can be helpful, if there's information that I can provide, here's some of the ways you can contact me. I do have a website. It's just tguskey.com. If you go there, you can see, download articles and presentations, blogs from EdWeek and that sort of thing that might be helpful. That's my email address at the university. I'm currently sort of serving two masters. I am on the faculty of both the University of Kentucky and the University of Louisville. In Michigan terms, that's like being on the faculty of Michigan State and University of Michigan at the same time. Right? That's my Twitter address. It's just at tguskey. If you do any posting about the conference, please include me as a part of that. And then that's my phone number. However, if you call that number, the phone that's in my bag up here is going to ring. So it's not as though you need to go through lots of people to contact me either. I wanted to start, too, by sharing with you our presentation this morning is going to be a little different from other conference presentations. At regular intervals throughout, I'm going to stop. I'm going to ask you to turn to the people at your table and share your perspectives on these ideas with them and gain a sense of their perspectives, too. It's going to be sort of a collaborative learning experience. However, in order for that to work, you must understand the disposition of the people with whom you're going to be sharing. I've been working a lot recently with David Johnson, and you probably know that David, along with his brother Roger, do a lot of work in cooperative learning. They've helped me understand that if you want people to collaborate, they need to know the disposition each brings to that interaction. And so, to start our morning, I have a brief activity. I'd like you to take a moment to think of what your disposition is today, and then take a very careful look at the people at your table, the people with you may be sharing, to get a sense of their dispositions too. Now, to help you with this, I have three disposition options I'm going to present. And what I would like you to do is consider each of these three and pick out which one best captures your disposition today. So, are you ready? All right, here's the first. Option number one is, I feel much better now that I've given up hope, right? I mean, here in Michigan, educators are under a lot of pressure, and it could be the pressures that led to an abandonment of hope, and that would actually be okay. Now, option number two is different. Option number two is, I've given up my search of truth, and now I'm looking for good fantasy, right? Sometimes under great pressure, we turn to the fantasy road, it provides a bit of relief. And option number three, different still. Option number three is, I'm not perfect, but parts of me are excellent, right? So, this is your task. Turn to the people at your table, share with them your disposition today, and get a sense of their dispositions too. Now, to review, once again, they are, number one, feel better now I've given up hope. Two, give my search of truth, now I'm looking for good fantasy. And of course, three, not perfect, but parts of me are excellent. And work quickly, we're only going to take about 1 minute to do this. Okay, may I interrupt your conversations, please? Now, to give me a sense of where we are as a group today, let me ask, among these three, which best captures your disposition today, recognizing, of course, that dispositions can change from day to day or even throughout the course of a day. But right now, how many would say that theirs is really best captured by option number one, I feel much better now that I've given up hope? Maybe a few folks there. That's fine. All right. How many say this is really number two? Give my search of truth now. I'm looking for good fantasy. Wow, a lot of ladies there. and how many say there's really three, not perfect, but parts of me are excellent? Very good. Did you share with your college which parts? No? Actually, last summer, I had a chance to share this with another group of educators, and in the very front was seated an elderly lady. When we finished, she turned to me and said, you know, my husband's kind of two and three. I said, really, how's that? She said, well, most of the parts he thinks are excellent are really a fantasy, right? I don't even ask anymore. If you go to the website, this is what the opening page looks like. And I share this with you just because you can download copies of presentations there, too. There are presentations on grading, on reporting, on professional learning, and various things. The young group of people that helped me establish the website suggested that we password protect the presentations, but if you want to look at the presentation on grading, just go up here to resources, you click there, the drop-down menu, the password for the grading presentation is grading. So it doesn't take a lot to get to that. I also wanted to share with you that in the time we have together this morning, I am not going to be sharing with you opinions. I know a lot of people that talk about grading are anxious to share with you their opinions, but I just don't do that. I don't think that anybody wins those arguments. I'm going to be sharing with you what we know, what evidence we have that we can support. And a lot of that evidence is captured in this book that came out last year called What We Know About Grading. This was actually prompted by a call from the American Educational Research Association to the field of researchers to identify areas in education that we would provide a summary of the research over the last 100 years. AERA was celebrating its 100th year anniversary. And so together with Sue Brookhart, we put together a team that looked at all the research we could identify on grading, and it's captured in this book. A lot of what I'm going to be sharing with you today is actually drawn from that. Now, we do have some sort of learning targets, as any good professional learning experience should, of what we hope to accomplish in the time we have together this morning. First, I want to share with you a little bit of the brief history of grading. We're going to talk about the advantages and disadvantages, the shortcomings of different grading strategies. And then finally, I'd like to talk about implementing more effective grading strategies, especially, I know many of you are engaged in this practice of looking at what we call standards-based kind of grading. I'd like to share with you a few ideas on that. So, to get started, here are some of the things we know about grading. And I should preface this by letting you know how I got interested in this. My interest in grading began my very first year teaching. As Ken told you, I was a middle grade neat teacher, and it was the practice, I taught grades 7 and 8, it was a practice in our middle school to give final examinations to our 8th graders. We thought that was a good thing, we thought it would get them ready for what they're going to face in high school. And I remember the very first year doing this, because I prepared the exam, and I was really proud of it, and I was standing outside my door, the classroom door, as the kids were coming in to take their exam. And down the hall came one of my super brightest students, Jessica. She had done so well the entire year. And as she came into the room, I said, "Hi, Jess, how are you today?" She said, "Fine, Mr. Guskey, how are you?" I said, "I'm great." I said, "Jess, did you study for your exam?" She said, "No, not really." I was shocked. I turned to her and said, "Jess, I don't understand. This is the really important part of your grade. How could you not study for your exam?" And she looked at me really quizzically and said, "Well, Mr. Guskey, I worked it out. I only need a 50.2 for my A. I don't have to study to get a 50.2. This 8th grader had worked it out to the 10th decimal place. What she needed to do to get her A in my class, and she was surprised that I didn't get it. And I was just shocked. And I thought, what have I done to this brilliant young woman? That school was not about learning, it was not about developing new understandings, it was about getting the grade. And she had done her job, and she was surprised that I didn't get it. And from that time on, I've always been concerned about that. So, here is some of what we've learned in investigating grading. Number one, we have a long history of research in this area. This actually surprised me when I first entered this to find out how much we know, how long we've known it, how little has found its way into our practice today. I'm convinced there's not another area in all of education where the gap is bigger between our knowledge base and our practice than in the area of grading. Let me give you an example. I found this study where these two researchers, their names were Daniel Starch and Edward Elliott, they were concerned with teacher subjectivity in grading. Now, we always know that's been a big deal, but here's the way they chose to investigate it. They took two compositions that had been prepared by students, they made copies, and they sent those compositions to 200 middle school and high school English language arts teachers. How many of you have a background primarily in English language arts? All right, these were the directions. They said to the teachers, "We'd like you to grade these papers by whatever criteria, whatever standards you use in your class. We'd like you to assign a letter grade and percentage grade to both of the papers." They got the papers back from the teachers and found the grades were all over. Just all over. About 15% of the teachers gave the papers a grade of A, the highest grade possible. 12% gave failing grades to exactly the same papers. In terms of percentage grades, they ranged from 64 to 98 on the first paper, from 50 to 97 on the second paper. Starch and Elliott published their study. But as soon as their study came out, people criticized them. And he said, well, first of all, you chose writing. Writing's a very subjective judgment in the first place. Not everyone agrees on what good writing is, so you stack the odds in your favor. Second, you chose middle school and high school English language arts teachers. And everybody knows they're a crazy lot, and you can't trust them anyway. So why would you expect any different results? So what Starch and Elliott did is they took two math papers and repeated their study. Same thing. Math papers, 200 middle school and high school math teachers, identical directions. Grade the papers according to whatever you use. Found greater variation among the math teachers than they did the English language arts teachers. Now, how could that be? Well, some of the math teachers just kind of correct answers because they felt that's what kids would have to do when they took the large-scale assessments. But a lot of the math teachers gave partial credit. How they gave the partial credit varied drastically. Some took offer labels, some did not. Grades were all over. Now, I doubt if those results surprise you very much. From the dilemmas we're going through today, trying to score authentic assessments, performances, portfolios, it probably sounds familiar. What I think will surprise you is to discover when Starch and Elliott did their research. I'll give you a hint. Starch and Elliott conducted their study the same year that this was the headline in the newspaper. Yeah, Starch and Elliott published their study in 1912. We have known about this for a long time. And I know what you're thinking. Tom, we've come so far. We do it so much better today than we did it in 1912. Well, another researcher by Brimmy decided to find out if that was the case. So what Brimmy did is he took the same composition that Starch and Elliott used in 1912. He made copies of it. He sent it to 100 teachers with the same direction that Starch and Elliott had employed. The one difference was this. All of the teachers in Brimmy's study had taken part in a very extensive professional learning program on the traits of writing. They had been trained on how to score writing samples. His results? Identical to what Starch and Elliott found. Percentage grades ranged from 50 to 96. Brimmy's study? 2011. 100 years, we haven't come so far. So that brings me to this next point. We know that the research hasn't had a lot of impact on our practice. So the question is, what has? What I'd like you to do is think about how you decided the way you were going to grade when you first began teaching. When you first entered the classroom, how did you decide your grading policies and practices? And I'd like you to turn to the people at your table and just share with them your personal story and see if you can find any common elements. Again, just 1 minute. Share your personal stories, see if you can find any common elements in those stories about how you decided the way you were going to grade. Okay, again, may I interrupt, please? Now, we asked that question in a study that we conducted to nearly 500 teachers. And let's see if what they told us is similar to what you and your colleagues just discovered. What those teachers told us was this. There is nothing in our background that gave us any idea how to do it. Nobody talked about it in our undergraduate preparation. Don't talk about it in graduate classes. And aside from the training we go through when our school or district adopts a new online grading program, we don't even talk about it in terms of professional learning. So what happens is this. We become teachers, we find we have to do it. Most of us reflect back on what was done to us. And in those reflections, we try to come up with practices we think are fair, equitable, and educationally sound. The problem we have is that most of us reflect back on what was done to us most recently. What was done to us most recently was done to us by college and university professors. If there is any level of education at which almost everything that's done in grading is totally evil and corrupt, it is the college university level. But we also found that we try to accomplish too much with a single reporting device, like a report card. It's always a mistake. When you think about grading and reporting, you have to think much more broadly about this and all the different devices we use to communicate information about student learning to students, parents, and families. And so that's why we never recommend having a report card committee. Instead, have a reporting committee. that can consider things like email messages and telephone calls, parent-teacher conferences, student-led conferences, all these different devices available to us. It brings me to this next point, that one of the major challenges we face is we don't agree on why or how we're going to do it. I have two basic questions, again, that I'd like you to consider with your colleagues. And there are no right or wrong answers to these. It's just your opinion on some pretty critical issues with regard to grading. Here they are. First, why do we do it? What's the purpose of grading? What purpose does that actually serve? And then second, we know when a teacher determines a grade they put on a report card, the teacher considers a wide variety of sources of evidence. I mean, typically we use major exams and compositions are almost always there, but what about formative assessments? Should they count? What about class participation, homework activities? What do you think should count when we determine a grade that we then put on a report card? Two questions with your colleagues. Again, 1 minute. How do you agree or disagree on these basic issues with regard to grading? 1 minute. See how you do. Okay, let's get back together again, please. Now, I ask you to consider these questions for two reasons. First, we're going to use this to extend our conversation about grading. But second, researchers have asked educators exactly these questions as well. And when they ask the question about purpose, they find the answers of most educators can generally be classified into one of these six broad categories. And I'm guessing if we surveyed everybody here, it's likely many of your responses would have fallen in these categories as well. One of the reasons we do it is that we're trying to communicate how well the kids are doing in school to parents and to families. A second reason is to provide information for the students themselves, especially for the purposes of self-evaluation. Third, we use grades to select and identify our group students in the various educational programs. You have to have decent grades to be promoted from one grade level to the next. You need high grades to get into honors or advanced classes. You clearly need high grades to get into college or university. Low grades, well, that's usually the first indication some additional assessment may be necessary to determine a student has special needs. Four, to provide incentives. Now again, people argue about this all the time, but the evidence is pretty clear. What is the first thing students ask when you announce there's going to be a quiz or an assessment? Yes. Is it for a grade? How many points are you going to be on it? Right? And suppose you turned to them and said, no, it doesn't count. Well, who studies for a test that doesn't count? Right? So clearly there's some incentive value. Number five, we always look at grades when we evaluate the effectiveness of various educational programs. If the program's working well, we would hope the grades are going up. And finally, to show evidence of effort or responsibility on the part of students. Now, we could argue that any of these might be legitimate purposes, but if I ask you to rank order these in terms of their importance, from the most to the least important, to give what you would pick for the two extremes, just for yourself, among these six, what would you pick as the most and least important of these six purposes? Are you having choices? Now, watch carefully. Which did you pick as number one, the most important? How many said it was the first, communicate with parents, right? How many said it was second, information for students, right? How many said it was third, select identify a group, right? How many said it's four, provide incentives? How many said five, value your programs, right? How many said six, evident responsibility? All right, among these, which did you say was least important? How many said information for parents? Information for students? Select to identify a group, provide incentives, evaluate programs, every responsibility. The variation you saw among us here is the same variation we would find if we were all on the faculty of a single school. You know what that shows? We don't agree. We don't agree on why we're doing it in the first place. And that is the first issue as leaders in this area you must confront. Because when we don't agree on purpose, what we try to do is come up with some reporting device that serves all these purposes. And what we come up with is one of them doesn't serve any of them very well at all. You cannot serve all these purposes with a single device. is impossible. In some cases, these purposes are counter to each other. I mean, here, to the degree you focus on 1 and 2, you must be willing to give up 3 and 5. Because if you focus on 1 and 2, what you hope is that all the kids do well. But if all the kids do well, there's no variation in the grades. They all get the same high grades. If there's no variation, you can't use it for selection. You can't use it for evaluation. Those two things depend on there being variation. And right here is where we have found that about 80% of the schools in our nation fail in their efforts to revise reporting because they charge ahead changing the report card without dealing with the purpose up front. You have to do that first. You've got to sit down as professionals. You've got to reach consensus. I do not have evidence to show you that any one of these is more important than the other. I do have evidence to show that consensus among the faculty in a school about the purpose is essential to your work. Now, one caution to you. Increasingly, as I'm called upon to work with schools and school districts, they'll ask me to do an evening session for parents. They're going to make some changes in the grading policy and practices, want to do an evening session with parents, and oftentimes I take parents through exactly the same exercise. I can tell you this. The variation you saw among us as educators does not exist among parents. Not at all. Because if we came to your school and did this, I can tell you right now exactly what we would find because it's been the same in every school we've ever been. 90% of the parents are going to tell you the purpose of the report card is for me. That is a primary source of evidence I use to find out how my kid is doing in school. So while we may be diverse in our perspectives, parents are not. Parents are extremely consistent in this. Now, researchers have also asked educators about what source of evidence they use when they determine grades. And this is the list they've generated. It'd be very unusual to find any teacher that incorporate all of these. But some of the things we find included, are like major exams and compositions are almost always there. Some debate today about the inclusion of formative assessments, projects and reports, student portfolios, exhibits of their work are increasing in popularity today, lab projects in some classes, notebooks and journals in others. Classroom observations, a bit more prevalent elementary than we find middle school or high school. Then we have oral presentations in their various formats. Homework is big, both completion and quality. Completion says they do it, quality says they do it well or accurately. Class participation counted by some teachers, work ethic, neatness of work, the effort they put forth. Class attendance is actually more prevalent at the post-secondary level. Punctuality of assignments, a lot of teachers say, oh no, I don't count punctuality. But the typical policy, a day late, a grade lower. That's counting punctuality. The same way with behaviors and attitudes. You say, oh, no, I've never considered their attitude behaviors. But every teacher knows. In every class you teach, there's always one student who is kind and sweet, brightens the classroom they walk in, volunteers to do things for you. For unexplained reasons, her name is always Jennifer, right? And then you've always got another kid, downright obnoxious, goes out of his way to get to you. He may be Ralph. If they have exactly the same number, there is something in us that the teacher doesn't want to give them the same grade. Then a progress they made. Now again, we could argue that any of these might be a legitimate source of evidence. What I'd like you to do is just look at this list and give me a count, a total number of those that you use or would advocate using to determine a grade you put on a report card. Of these, how many would you use or advocate using? All right, heavy choices. Now watch carefully. Did anybody include 3 or less? How about 4? 5? 6? 7? 8? 9? 10 or more? Ta-da! The second problem. Not only do we disagree on purpose, we disagree on what counts. Now think of the message that sends to kids. What it says to a kid is when you walk out of this class and into this one, all the rules change. The purpose of grading could change. What counts as part of grade, all of that changes. Now, some of your students are very clever, and they see this as a huge game, and they become strategists in the game, wanting to figure it out and how to play, and some are very, very good. My student, Jessica, she had it down. But for a lot of kids, this is a total mystery. And so before the report card comes out, their parent turns them to the dinner table and asks, what grade are you going to get in this class? And they respond, in all honesty, I don't know, right? See, if it's supposed to be a communication device, we're not serving that purpose well at all. And that leads me to this fourth point. We have to recognize that grading is really not essential to the instructional process. We have lots of evidence to show that the teachers can and do teach many things very well without grades, and students can and do learn many things very well without grades. And so, if it's not essential for teaching, and it's not essential for learning, we must use it for some other purpose. My classic example of this, I would not say that I am necessarily a strong advocate of dress codes for teachers, but I know our students pay attention to what we wear. And if you ever doubt that or think that may not be true, just try this little experiment. Try wearing the same clothes 2 days in a row, all right? That's all you have to do, because I promise you at least 20 kids will ask you about it, and they will not be kind in their comments, all right? It'll be like, whoa, Mr. Guskey, what is this? Rough night last night? That's what you had on yesterday. And because they pay attention, we need to pay attention. All the things matter to kids. The way we dress is the way we present ourselves to them. Our breath. If 7 kids offer you a breath mint, it's not them. Right? Fingernails. All that matters. Now, there's another aspect of this, though, we must keep in mind. Although grading isn't essential, checking is. But checking's different from grading. This is a real important distinction to keep in mind. What this says is, in any successful teaching and learning exchange, a teacher must provide regular and specific checks on learning progress, and you must pair with those checks guidance and direction to students as to how they can improve. It is the second part that we've missed so much in our assessment work, because we've concentrated almost exclusively on the assessments. But it's not the assessments that make the difference. It's what you do with those results that makes the difference. It's following assessments with high quality corrective instruction, a different approach to what we did initially. But this is a very important distinction to keep in mind. You see, kids need to know there is consequence to what they do in school and don't do in school. But the consequence doesn't always have to be reflected in a grade. And one of the ways in which we're getting into very serious trouble today in grading, legally, is we often punish kids academically through grades for what are often behavioral infractions. And every time we have done that, and it's been challenged legally, we have lost. Kids need to know there's consequence. Consequence doesn't have to be reflected in terms of the grade. Which brings me to point number 5, that grading methods really appropriately vary depending upon the purpose that we choose. And you always have to identify your purpose first. Once you identify the purpose, then it gives you some ideas about what will be the most appropriate grading method for that. Now, I need everybody to check the security of their seats right now, because I'm about to share with you some information that's going to shake your understanding of this whole process. All right? I'd like to take on the 4 most common grading methods and share with you some of their advantages and shortcomings. Now, the first, we need to establish our purpose. And suppose we did this. We sit down as a group of professionals. After some discussion, we come to some consensus. And here's what we decide. We want to accurately and meaningfully describe students' current level performance. Now, that seems a rather innocent and innocuous kind of purpose. However, let me point out some things to you in this that are going to profoundly change what you're currently doing. This says students' current level performance. As soon as you include that in your purpose statement, it means your throw-out averaging. Because I don't care where you started, I care a lot about where you are right now. Something that simple can have profound effects on what you do. Now, if that's our purpose, what I'd like to do is take on the most common grading methods and share with you some advantage and disadvantage. First, of course, letter grades. Letter grades dominate American education. Do you know that letter grades are used in 87% of American high schools? They're used in slightly fewer middle schools and fewer still elementary, slightly more college universities. Now, letter grades, you can see, are just labels attached to categories of performance. They offer a brief description of the adequacy of that performance. Generally, a student, most people think they understand letter grades. However, do require the integration of all this diverse information into a single symbol, which can make interpreting it really difficult. Cutoffs between the gate and categories are arbitrary. I'm going to show you in just a moment how arbitrary that is, and have almost easily misinterpreted. Now, there are places around the country where we have taken on the idea that letter grades are evil. We need to get rid of them. A lot of people have this misunderstanding. If you go to where standard space, you got to read letter grades. Well, no, it's just labels attached to categories of performance. We actually went through this in my state. In Kentucky, when some of the reforms were passed, our Department of Education came out and said, elementary schools, we don't want you using letter grades anymore, especially primary. K-3, don't use letter grades. And so what most of our elementary teachers did is they developed a different set of labels for the categories of performance. And most decided to use the categories as we use in our state assessment. There's a state assessment in Kentucky that classifies student performance at one of four levels. So on the state assessment, students can score a 1, 2, 3, or 4, and we label those novice, apprentice, proficient, and distinguished. Now, to be honest with you, I've always been troubled by that, simply because we couldn't get parts of speech straight. We have two adjectives and two nouns, and we should have stuck with one. But that aside, the kids who get letter grades, they get novice, apprentice, proficient, distinguished. The problem is this. Their report card goes home, and do you know, every single parent we interviewed translated that directly. Distinguished is an A, proficient is a B. We accomplished nothing. And so if you think by changing the labels, you're changing interpretation, you can forget it. Parents can translate it to exactly the same thing. Now, in some cases, we take this one further extreme. At my university 3 years ago, we went through a nasty debate on grading. It was ugly. It broke up friendships that endured for years. It was a topic of editorials in the newspaper for weeks. The essence of the debate was whether we, as a faculty, are going to give plus and minus grades. Oh, it was ugly. And at one point, I was actually subpoenaed to appear before our university senate. Someone here that did some research on grading said, they sent me a subpoena, you're required to appear. I said, a subpoena, really? You could have called. You know, it's not like I have a girlfriend in Argentina. Come on. And so I go before the Senate, and they say, Professor Guski, what do you think of plus and minus grades? I said, to be honest with you, this is a much simpler issue than you've been debating. It is, truly, it comes down to this. Do you want to have a 5-category system, or do you want to have a 12-category system? That's it, 5 or 12. And if you think more is better, why stop at 12? You don't have to stop at 12, all right? Let's consider grade point 0 to 4.0. Just go to the 10th place. That gives you 41 categories. Oh, and you may think that's silly. That is exactly the grading system that is used today at the University of Washington. You don't like that? How about percentages? 101 discrete categories of student performance. But you know what happens when you increase the number of categories? The influence of subjectivity on the grade goes way up. And what that means is a chance of two equally competent judges looking at exactly the same body of evidence and coming up with exactly the same grade drops drastically. And I also shared with them, in K through 12 education in our state, where we have very clearly defined learner goals, which few university professors have, we have a well-refined student assessment system, which no university professor has, we train people to evaluate assessments, we sometimes have trouble getting them to agree in 4 categories. They think they can do it in 12? Not a chance. Not a chance. Significant research evidence shows once you move beyond 5-6 categories at most, human beings cannot make that fine discrimination. But we remain undaunted and move to percentage grades, which is kind of intriguing in itself because back in the early 1900s, we recognized the problems with percentage grades. 101 discrete categories of student performance. The Starch and Elliott studies and others were replicating it at that time showed it was terribly unreliable. And so we abandoned percentage grades back then. 1920s and 1930s, that's when the letter grade system was developed. We started with 3 categories, we went to 5, and that sort of persisted. And then we kept using that until we hit somewhere around the 1980s, 1990s. Because then we started using computers for grading. and computerized grading programs were not developed by educators who had any sense of this history. They were developed by software engineers who like percentages. They're a lot like money. 101 different levels. Easy to divide, the halves, quarters. Of all the grading systems we have available to us, the one that's most difficult to defend from a practical, an ethical, or an educational perspective is a percentage grade system. And here are some of the reasons why. Number one, just think of the scale. In the typical letter grade scale, we get five levels, A, B, C, D, and F. We have four levels of passing, one level of failure. This communicates that we are, as educators, four times better at distinguishing levels of passing as we are levels of failure. That kind of makes sense. But watch what happens when you go to percentages. The scale flips. Now I have a scale two-thirds of which denote levels of failure. 65 levels of failure. Do we need all those levels of failure? Really? Has any kid ever argued with you about what level of failure they achieved? I mean, can you imagine a kid saying, you gave me a 42, I think I deserve a 45, right? Why do we need all those levels of failure? And people say we really don't use all those levels, so then why have them? Have your skill go from 0 to 50. Have 10 levels of failure. Are 10 levels of failure not sufficient for anybody? Why do we need all those levels of failure? And then it gets you into all these other problems, because then people get into these terribly heated discussions about the zero. What are we going to do about the zero? And because you give a kid a zero in a percentage grade system, that kid has to get 9 perfect papers to recover. A single zero pretty much dooms a kid to failure. But what you got to understand is the problem is not the zero. The problem is a percentage grade system. Do away with percentages, the problem goes away. I give zeros in my class. Zero means I have no evidence. As soon as you get me some evidence, then I can change that zero. But going from zero to passing is zero to one, not zero to 65. The kid has a chance to recover. And that's all I'd ask. Give the kid a chance to recover. And you can't do it in a percentage grade system with that zero. The other thing is we try to attach these percentages to performance, and it's almost always inaccurate. See, we've always had this understanding that 80% means mastery. But you just get into 80%. I just at 80%, then I would consider that mastery. Well, you see, it really depends on the standard itself. For example, would 80% be sufficient if you were teaching children to cross the street safely, right? Maybe not. You probably want something a little better than 80%, right? Not unless we picked the 20% that didn't make it. I don't know, right? How about being honest? But you accept from a kid, you know, today's Wednesday. It's my day to lie to you. The rest of the week, I'll be honest, but today is my day off, right? No, that's not mastery, right? How about would you get on a plane where the pilot is successful 80% of the time landing it safely, right? Would you want kids leaving a high school shop with 80% of the fingers with which they entered, right? But there are other instances where 80% can be truly remarkable performance, really outstanding performance. Let me give you some sports analogies. How many of you like professional football? Do you know, if an NFL quarterback completes 65% of the forward passes thrown, a 65% pass completion rate, that ranks that quarterback among the top five of all NFL quarterbacks in all of history. 65% pass completion rate. How many like professional basketball? One of the greatest basketball players of all time, before LeBron, clearly Michael Jordan, right? Michael Jordan had one of the highest success rates shooting from the floor. He was amazingly accurate. Do you know his success rate while shooting from the floor? 49.7. That was remarkable. Very few NBA players even get close to that. How many of you like professional baseball? You know, if a Major League Baseball player gets a hit one-third the times they step to the plate, one-third, that would rank them among the top hitters in all of Major League Baseball. Applying percentages to performance just doesn't seem to work. And not only that, it depends on the assessment. We are part of an assessment consortium here. But we can alter assessments in lots of different ways to pose very different challenges to students. Let me give you an example. Suppose I wanted to assess a pretty simple concept in social studies. American history and knowledge of U.S. presidents. I could do it in lots of different ways. Suppose that I constructed my assessment using open-ended constructive response items. Here's an example. With the 17th president of the United States. Now, this is the classic example of a very low-level question that is extremely difficult. A lot of people have this misunderstanding of Bloom's taxonomy that low level means easy. Not really. Very low level, only requiring knowledge But if I pose this question to American high school students today, success rate is less than 10%. Now, when you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because a lot of people know that Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president, and the president followed Lincoln had the same name as the president followed Kennedy. Both were assassinated in office, and the vice president's name was Johnson, all right? But putting the math and history together is kind of tough. So what I could do, I could change the formatted assessment. Suppose instead of open-ended, I made it multiple choice. If I pose the question in this format to American high school students, success rate climbs to 30%. I have three times more successful students, same item, same question, same understanding, same knowledge, same standard, same goal, three times more successful students just by changing the format. Now, it's multiple choice. There are four options. 25% will get it right by guessing. So 30% isn't that great. But still, I've tripled the success rate on the item. I could change it once more. If I pose the question in this format to American high school students, success rate climbs to 60%. And we might assume that if you can't answer correctly now, you don't know a lot about U.S. residents, right? And I could even change it once more. Under this format, success rate climbs to 95%. Answer D throws off a few kids, and we're not sure why. All right, now, here's my point. I can construct assessments with items of any of those four types. Would it be fair for me to set the same cutoff for grades on the assessments, exactly the same point? Not at all. They pose very different challenges to students. And you know who controls that? I do. I am the god of grading in my class. I can make that assessment as easy or as challenging as I want it to be. I mean, I've told state officials here in Michigan, you want to increase the pass rate on the state assessments? No problem. Let me design the assessments, all right? We can do it. I just showed you how. And that's why something like this is okay. They're just labels attached to categories of performance. You can have 1, 2, 3, and 4. You want to get your kids college and career ready? This is what college universities use. We equate this to letter grades. We've gone to this at my university. We decided to drop the D grade. D was always a gentleman's F anyway, right? Right? And do we really need it anymore? Right? I mean, honestly, we've gone to four levels, A, B, C, and F. They are just labels attached to category performance. The label doesn't matter. For all I care, you could use emojis, all right? The one thing that doesn't work is this. This doesn't work, right? 101 discrete category performance we cannot defend under any conditions. And so that's why we have to think about recording things in terms of rubrics, not in terms of percentages. If you look at my grade book, everything that goes in my grade book is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. I give them a 10-point quiz. Maybe these 10 things are so important they need to get 10 out of 10 to get them right. All right? And so to get a 4, 10 out of 10. Next one up, well, now I've got some latitude. All these things are not that important. So now this time, they got to get 8 out of 10 to get a 4. I let them know ahead of time, but what goes in to the grade book, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, for all. That brings me to the notion of the standards-based. Actually, breaking subject areas down to these various components, and there's some really good reasons that we can do that and should do that. But there are some ways in which we've been failing in these efforts as well. There are a couple of things about the standards-based I wanted to share with you. The first is that we need to change the way we develop rubrics. See, when the standards movement was first begun, the way we developed rubrics associated with them is we started off with a level of proficiency. We typically called that a level 3. We had a few levels leading up to it, and we always had a level above. That was sort of the exemplary, the outstanding, the exceeding. And that worked when people were trying to implement the elementary level, because a level above was always easier to identify. If you're working on third grade standards, the level above, it's fourth grade stuff. What happened, though, when we tried to transfer that to the middle school and high school level is it killed us. Because the interest of students and their parents at that level is not what do I have to do to be proficient. It is, what do I have to do to get an A? And that whole idea caused the failure of many standards-based systems in many places around the country. In one very prominent school district outside of Washington, D.C., the parents were so upset by this. And again, it was because they got some advice from a consultant that said the top level has to be a wow. You know, it's got to be wow, just blow my socks off. The parents were so upset, they called that the unicorn grade. It was this mystical creature we kind of believed in, but no one had ever seen one, right? And so what we're doing now to avoid that is going back to what Benjamin Bloom told us in the 1970s. Benjamin Bloom, in the 1970s, was working on what he called mastery learning. He knew whatever he called mastery, people were going to disagree with him. But he was really, really very bright. And what Bloom did is he just turned it around. He went back to teachers and said, okay, do you give grades? Yes, yes, we give grades. Okay, are the grades based upon learning, not based upon a kid standing among classmates? Don't tell me you give grades just to the top, the A's to the top 20%. No, no, they're really based upon learning. He said, fine, tell me what you expect for an A. I don't have to tell you what mastery is. You've already established that. Just make that clear. Tell me what A-level work looks like. Show me an example of A-level work. Define your criteria in terms of that A-level. And that is the new approach we're taking to developing of rubrics that makes sense and leads to greater success. The idea is begin with your model of excellence. Don't start in the middle and try to go up or down. Start at the top. Whatever that is, start there and then go down from there. That's number one. The second thing is to think about the labels we attach to these. This became very evident to me a couple of years ago. I was invited to New Zealand to work on the National Assessment Program. Great National Assessment Program there. It's all performance-based, and the kids' performance on these tasks is evaluated at one of three levels for each task. You either don't pass, you pass, or it can be exemplary. And passing is really pretty high. But just three levels, those three. And the New Zealand educators turned to me and said, what do you do in the States? I said, well, we have a few more levels. We have things like not started, just beginning, in progress, almost there, mastered, extended. The New Zealand educators turned to me and said, so let us get this straight. You have four levels of not pass. I said, yeah, I guess that's true. So I came back from that, and I just went around our country collecting labels, how we label different categories of student performance. This is a list that I generated. Now, you can see four seem to be the magic number, and I tried to divide these between levels of understanding and levels of mastery. I'm not sure they're really distinct. But we use labels such as modest, intermediate, proficient, superior, beginning, progressing, adequate, exemplary, novice, apprentice, proficient, distinguished. That's the Kentucky model. And we have unsatisfactory, need to improve, and satisfactory, outstanding. Could be different from below basic, basic, proficient, advanced, below standard, approaching, and meet standard, see standard, pre-emerging, emerging, inquiring standard, incomplete, limited, partial, thorough, which should never be confused with how often they do it. That can be rarely, occasionally, frequently, consistently, never, seldom, usually, always. Do you use effectiveness, evidence, accomplishment? Is it any wonder the parents translate things to letter grades? We can't be consistent in labels we use. So here's what we did. We took this list and we gave it to parents. And we asked, are there any that you really like? Are there any that seem particularly meaningful to you? And unfortunately, nothing came out on top. Parents were spread all over. But then we asked, are there any you don't like? Are any particularly unclear? And there were some real losers. You have only 30 seconds with the people at your table to look at this list and tell me if you can identify the two that parents said were confusing, they did not understand, and felt lacked any community value. What would they be? Okay, have it? The two that parents identified for us, they did not like. Number one, emerging. Over and over, parents criticized about emerging. To them, emerging invoked this image of a slimy creature crawling out of a swamp, right? Emerging literacy just meant the creature was carrying books. Over and over, parents criticized about our response was emerging kind of means beginning. And their response, if you meant beginning, just say beginning, all right? That's a really valid comment. The other the parents did not like was exceeds. Over and over, parents told us they could understand how you could have specific criteria for outstanding, distinguished, exemplary, but exceeds, it's more than we expect, but we cannot tell you what it is, right? It's out there somewhere. We think we're going to know it when we see it. We just can't tell you ahead of time, right? It lacks communicative value, right? And it brings me to, this is actually one of my favorite cartoons I have in my office. It brings me to this last point that I'm going to share with you, and that is that we always have to grade according to learning criteria, not a norm-based criteria. This is the one thing that's truly most firmly established in all of our research. We need to grade kids according to what they've learned and what they're able to do, not according to standing among classmates. There just can't be any debate on this any longer. If you grade kids in normative-based, then we find that it doesn't tell you anything about learning, that it actually makes learning competitive. Kids have to compete against each other. Few hear scarce high grades. That it actually discourages student collaboration and diminishes the relationship between kids because you're interfering with the competition. You've probably seen this before. This professor that the student says, "Can you curve my grade?" The professor says, "Sure. How's this?" Boom. If you grade according to criteria, all those flip. Now we actually are describing what the kids have learned, and it actually, the kids are competing against the curriculum, not against each other. That it puts them on the same side. And actually, it puts teachers on the same side. Now, I know this makes sense. And I know that it's something you'd say, well, all of our teachers do this. We don't grade on the curve any longer. We recognize the difficulties of that. And I say it's great, but let me remind you of a policy that dominates American education today, completely the opposite of this. You know what it is? The determination of class rank and the selection of a class valedictorian. Because we have the idea that valedictorian should be based on the student that has the highest weighted grade point average. Well, where did that come from? Does anybody even know where that came from? Because I work in an environment, people pay me to figure this out. Do you know the word valedictorian has nothing to do with achievement? Nothing. The word valedictorian actually comes from the Latin. It means to say farewell. It's a person selected to give a farewell address at a graduation ceremony. You know what salutatorian means? Salutatorian means greeter. When you walk into Walmart, right? The person who talks to you, right? They're really a salutatorian, right? People say we need to do it because the college universities demand it. Well, hold on. Do you know of all the fine college universities there are here in the state of Michigan, and there are some really great ones here, not a single one selects their valedictorian in that way. Not one. They have valedictorians, sure. But all the college universities in this state use the Latin system for the graduates. The graduate students, cum laude, magna cum laude, summa cum laude. It's a criterion-based system. How many of you graduated cum laude from your college university? Right? It's a wonderful distinction to have. And you know what? I'll bet if I asked you had no idea how many other students reach that level at your school. Because if we have 100 students reach it at mine, we're very proud. Why do we want it to be that one? Because whenever you do that, I can promise you this, the few kids who are in contention begin plotting with their parents when they are in middle school what they have to do to gain that senior distinction. It has nothing to do with achievement. It has everything to do with competition. It's detrimental to most of the kids that are there. You've got to grade according to criteria. But there are three different types of criteria that we use. We call them product, process, and progress. Here's what they mean. Product criteria are common indications of learning. Process are really things that got them there. So if you count homework, you're grading in terms of process. If you count class participation, if you count effort, all those are process criteria. Finally, we have progress. With progress, you don't care where they are, but how far they've come. Sometimes you produce improvement, value added grading. Now, what we know is this, all three of these are important, but all three are different. They're distinct. Where we get into trouble is when we combine them into a single grade. And what's really ironic about this, if you go to other places around the world, if you go to the Northern European countries, if you go to the Scandinavian countries, if you go to places in Asia, if you go to Canada and you look at their report cards, they separate these in report cards. Do you know we are one of the few developed nations in the world that persists in this idea of combining everything into a single grade? Why do we do that? There's no rational reason for doing it. If I were to say to you, I was going to take a measure of your height in inches, your weight in pounds, your average calorie intake per day, the number of minutes you spend exercising each day, and combine that in a single grade representing your physical condition, you would say to me, that's really dumb. I mean, why would you do that? But every day, teachers take evidence on achievements and effort and growth, and they combine them in a single grade. We think it makes sense. It doesn't. You go to their schools, they give a dashboard of information. They have an achievement grade, and they can use that for class rank and GPA. They give a separate grade for homework, a separate grade for class participation, separate grade for punctuality. When I looked at their system, I said, looks great. Looks like so much extra work. They said, it's easier than what you silly people do in the States. We collect the same information. We just don't worry about weighting it and combining it at the end. And so all those fights you have about how you combine it, we don't deal with it. We keep it separate. Now, let me show you a very quick example report card that does this. One I found in Canada. Here's their framework. High school report card. Not standards-based. Just separates like this. This report card is structured in such a way that they have a sort of section for each class. Each section begins with a photograph of the teacher. And ask them why they did this. They say, well, they just wanted to sort of personalize the report card. Then beside that, the name of the teacher, name of the class, then they have a band of grades, an achievement grade. Letter grade, prominently stated, use it for class rank, GPA if you want. Separate grade for homework, separate grade punctuality, separate grade effort. Those are associated with rubrics that have numbers. So the homework rubric, 1, 2, 3, 4. A 4, all homework assignments turned in time. A 3, 1 and 2 assignments missing. 2, 3, 5 assignments missing. 1, multiple assignments. Below that, then, there's a narrative with two parts. Class part, student part. The class part, the teacher adds 2 or 3 sentences what the class worked on, but then can add a sentence about the student. So what you're going to see is half the report card, 4 classes. I've altered it to suit my purposes, and I've included my dream team of teachers. Here's what half the report card looks like. Now, you look at this. There's the first language arts class, taught by Miss Angelou. And Miss Angelou says, this quarter we focus on poetry in different poetic forms. Students read both well-known lesser-known poets and constructed their own poems. Everybody in the class got those sentences. Miss Angelou had to enter that only one time. Then she adds, Chris, after participating in class discussions, wrote several excellent poems, but needs to be more conscientious about completing homework assignments on time. I looked down over this. This kid's got a problem with homework. Teachers are consistently noting that's really good information for me to have, and they suggest that it's easier than what we're currently doing. My question to you before we conclude our session today is, could you do this at your school? This is not a standards-based report card. Note there are no standards here. But this is the first step, pulling out those non-achievement factors from the achievement grade. No teacher was told how to develop an achievement grade. All they did is say, pull out the non-achievement factors. And I can tell you these are the most important. I'm sharing with you in our discussion following this a list of all these different processes that you want to pull out. But could you do it in your school? You've got 1 minute, few concluding comments, and we're going to end our session this morning. Okay, let's get back together, please. So, final summary before we take our break. Guidelines for better practice. Like I said, I don't know that we have sufficient knowledge to indicate what is best practice, but this will move us in the right direction. Number one, begin with your statement of purpose. You have to decide, and you have to reach consensus on that. Why are we doing it? For whom is the mission intended? What are the desired results to be? This should be your first step. I actually advocate you should print the purpose and report card itself. Right there in the top, big bold letters. Once you decide the purpose, questions about method become a lot easier to address. Second, accurate and meaningful description of student learning. This whole process of grading is much more challenging and effective communication is just document and quantify achievement. And the point is, if students or parents don't understand that information, then the communication has been lost. We need to make sure the people who are receiving the information understand what's intended there. And finally, we need to enhance teaching and learning, not to get in the way. And some of the things we do, ranking kids gets in the way. Every school I know that's gone away from a ranking system to a commodity system has found two things to occur. Number one, achievement in their school goes up. Achievement always goes up because, number two, kids start helping each other do well. Because helping each other doesn't hurt anybody's chances for success. See, this is what you always have to keep in mind. Grading is not an academic exercise. A lot of people try to convince you that it is, but it's not. It's also not a mechanical process. The machine can't do this for you. You have to decide. Because the bottom line is, grading's personal. No kid ever said, "Power School gave me this grade." They said, "You gave me this grade." Right? It's personal. And we have to always keep that in mind. This means when you move to reform grading, it's going to mean a very different kind of leadership. I'm sure you've heard this distinction made before that leaders know how to do things right, but our managers know how to do things right, leaders know the right things to do. You have a knowledge base in grading that you can use to really guide your reform efforts. We have evidence to back you up in making these changes, but you've got to make that courageous stand. You've got to be able to say, "I'm going to challenge the longest held traditions we have in American education," when you challenge grading. How many of you are familiar with this book? A really popular book in education. It talks about the change process. Who moved my cheese? Those not familiar, it starts with this metaphor, this mouse that has to learn to run this complicated maze. And it's very, very difficult, but he finally learns how to do it. And every day he's able to run that complicated maze in the same way he always gets there, always finds the cheese. And one day he gets there, cheese isn't there. He's so distraught. Does not enter change. I like the book. My problem with the book is this. This book deals with managing change. It doesn't deal with leading change. There's one thing I hope comes from this conference. It's your commitment to do that, to lead change based on what we know about this process. And actually, I'm working on a new book to help you. Here's mine. If I can ever be helpful to you, don't hesitate to get in touch with me. Thank you so much for being a part of our session today. Thank you.
Excellent presentation. Well, wow. I know that this kind of environment doesn't provide an opportunity for Q&A, but we do have an opportunity in Clinic A1. Tom will be there and continue the presentation and continue the discussion. A few announcements before you leave. First of all, the hotel layout is on the back of your program, so when you see the rooms in the program, hopefully you'll be able to find your way. Lunch will be back here in this room. This means that this area over here is the only one that we have to turn from a meeting into lunch, and there'll be an opportunity for you to exit the room so that they can set for lunch. And that's in the Michigan rooms 3 through 5 over here, to my left, your right. This wall will be drawn for the presentation, so look out for that. Today you should be wearing your white or blue badges. They will be checking for that at lunch. That means you're registered for today only, or today and tomorrow. On page 21, there's some announcements about how to have input into next year's program, how to apply for sketches if you haven't done that. We'll ask also all of the presenters, there's a microphone that will not project into the room. All of the sessions are recorded, audio recorded, and so we ask that you wear the lapel microphone while you're presenting so you can be recorded. Otherwise, you'll frustrate the attendees who want to hear what you had because they were in another session and all there is a blank, nothing on there. All of the presentations, I think virtually all of them, are now loaded into the system, and so they're available for you to look at both today, tomorrow, and after the conference. It'll be up for a couple of months following the conference. Since we're running a bit late, I'm going to say that we start instead of at 10:20. Let's start at, which is about 1 minute from now, let's start at 10:35, and we'll run till about 11:50. So the walls are coming. So if people over here, for those of you that know this conference at the Kensington, this is a hotel tradition. And even if we didn't need to do it, we'd go stand outside and watch the walls be moved. So thank you again, Tom.